the Russia-Ukraine war. We are closing in on the completion of 4 years of war. Hard to believe we're actually getting close to that date right now. And you would think that we are getting closer and closer to the end of that war, that we're looking to ramp it down, that we're looking to find peace by the best mechanism possible. You would be surprised then if that's what you thought, because as it's turning out, apparently President Trump is thinking about authorizing an offensive, a new offensive from the Ukraine side. And we're going to try to figure out how all this actually fits together with Ian Proud today. We've got him back, former British diplomat for His Majesty's Diplomatic Service 1999 to 2023 to include time in Moscow. So he's one of the really knowledgeable guys that we've had on the show, and especially on today's topic. Really glad to have you on. Welcome back to the show, Ian.
Great to see you again, Danny. Always nice to chat on your fantastic show.
And we love having you on here as well. Well, look, this Truth Social by Trump just literally minutes before we came on air here, where he says, "I'm speaking to President Putin now. The conversation is ongoing, a lengthy one, and I will report the contents, as will President Putin, at its conclusion. Thank you for your attention to this matter," which is kind of odd because he's apparently been talking to him, and then he stops while he's talking to him in the midst of it and tweets out with the Truth Social rather that he's talking to him. So kind of Trump-like, I guess. But what do you make of that? I mean, what is your thoughts? What even might be on the agenda here for this conversation?
Well, I think one of the things that will be on the agenda is Ukraine's request to have Tomahawk missiles. If you cast your mind back about a week ago when Zelensky first asked for that, one of the things President Trump said at that time was that he would want to talk to Putin first before making a decision. So that will very much be, it seems to me, at the top of the agenda, you know, right now. I mean, it's odd in a way because it's quite obvious what Putin will say if Trump asks him, should we give the Ukrainians cruise missiles? Putin will respond quite badly to that and say, well, no, if you do that, we'll escalate again, as we did a year ago with the use of an Arashnik missile.
Yeah, well, let's hope we don't get to that. Gary, I'm just wondering here, we had the British ambassador, I'm sorry, the Russian ambassador to the UK this morning was talking about some of that. Did we catch that? I didn't see on the list.
The whole process will definitely involve Americans, and this is a very serious escalation. Besides, this type of a missile has been also done in a nuclear variant, so you cannot tell whether it is nuclear or conventional one. So that is, it will not be a game changer, definitely, since the quantity of this missile will be small. It will not change the situation in the battlefield, but of course we will have to react very seriously towards this escalation and towards direct involvement of American military people into the process of launching them.
Now, he was pressed by the interviewer there, what would Moscow's reaction be if the Tomahawks are actually used? And he emphatically would not answer the question. He said that, oh, that's hypothetical. And then he answered that question there, but I'm asking you to parlance, you know, the diplomatic ease there. And what do you think might be on the phone call between Russia if Trump does use it?
Well, Putin will make it clear that Russia will respond directly to the deployment of much longer range Tomahawk missiles compared to, you know, the ATACMS missiles, which were discussed exactly 1 year ago. And he'll make it clear that it's Russia's position that there'll be a direct response to that. And he will threaten, Andrew Kalin, the Russian ambassador to the UK, did, impacts on US military assets. But I would be surprised, in fact, if he went that far, rather than launching some sort of a strike as he did a year ago. So, I mean, it will be a difficult conversation. And I my prediction will be that Trump will come out of that saying that he's not going to issue Tomahawk missiles. I see a little to suggest to me that Trump is going to come out of that conversation and think it's a good idea to let Zelensky have Tomahawk missiles. That's just how I'm calling it right now.
Well, let's hope that pays out, because other things that Trump said yesterday don't exactly give me a lot of confidence that he's going to be making rational choices about war and peace issues that make sense. Here's one, in fact, now in the, we're closing in on the fourth year of the war, just now months away from that. And one would think that we'd be looking to find ways to say, all right, let's just get this deal off the table. That would be the rational thing. But instead, Trump is saying this.
We'll be talking about the war with them, and we'll be talking about, I mean, they want to go offensive. I'll make a determination on that, but they would like to go offensive, you know that, and we'll have to make a determination.
Okay, so he's talking about that tomorrow, if he's talking to Putin today, tomorrow in Washington, Zelensky's going to be in town, and they're going to have a conversation, and of course, there's many things on his agenda, which we'll get to in a minute, but apparently, he wants to go on an offensive, and he's trying to talk Trump into it, and I can only imagine that in Zelensky's telling, he's going to directly connect the Tomahawk missile to that offensive operation. But let's just talk practicality for a moment. What the hell? Offensive at this time?
Yeah, no, it's completely crazy. And of course, it's offensive only in the use of missiles. Ukraine doesn't have the you know, troop density to actually launch a major offensive on the battlefield as such. So Zelensky sees this as some sort of magical bullet to kind of really escalate the war and draw NATO closer into its involvement. So, I mean, that, you know, it's a dangerous gamble by, you know, Zelensky. And I'm hoping Trump won't be sort of fooled by that, you know, quite frankly. But yeah, I mean, Ukraine has no capability to go on the military offensive on the battlefield. This is, you know, getting some free, yet more free weaponry from the West, which, by the way, Europe will pay for, not the US, because if the US supplies it, you know, we'll pay for it in Europe, just to escalate for no obvious advantage.
And, you know, I mean, let's just take a look at the last time there was a genuine Ukrainian offensive. And I'm not talking about the Kursk one, because that was an incursion that was tactical, and it had never any chance of producing any kind of even operational, much less strategic benefit. But the last time was in 2023, when at the end of 2022, when there had been two pretty meaningful Ukrainian tactical or even operational victories, where they drove Russia out of the Kherson, part of the Kherson province, and a huge swath of the Kharkiv Raj. So not minor at all, not so insignificant. And so they buoyed by that success, which was illusory in my view, but still they did have it on the ground. So they said, all right, let's have an offensive in 2023. And then they started from roughly November to really starting to build up. And there was a massive inflow of thousands of armored vehicles, tanks, self-propelled artillery pieces, infantry carriers, and the millions of rounds of various kinds of artillery shells, other kinds of ammunition, et cetera. And you had this long buildup until finally on, I think it was June the 4th, they actually launched off into that. Mm-hmm. So that's what it looks like when you're actually preparing for an offensive. Here, Ukraine has been continually on the defensive, and they're being driven back even to this day, and they're now suffering a lot more in the air. So upon what foundation can we even have this conversation?
Well, we can't. I mean, the war hasn't made sense since August 2023, when that counteroffensive, which, by the way, the British military were closely involved in the operational planning for, you know, completely faltered and stalled. You know, no progress has been made by the Ukrainian side since the time, apart from, as you said, the incursion, you know, into Kursk, which has now been completely kind of reversed. You know, Russia has slowly, very, very slowly, been making progress on the battlefield since that time, and continues to do so. Right now, you know, the progress is painfully slow. Ukraine is making some small counterattacks here and there along the front line, but nothing kind of really decisive. This war is going nowhere, and Ukraine doesn't have the troops to actually kind of launch something, you know, even if there was another massive buildup of artillery pieces, you know, armored personnel carriers, tanks, and all the rest of it, which isn't happening anyway. So that's why they want Tomahawk missiles to kind of escalate and actually provoke, because Zelensky knows it would provoke a really harsh reaction from the Russian side, which risks drawing NATO closer into the fight, which, you know, is a doomsday scenario, quite frankly.
And, you know, I mean, let's just talk about some of the military fundamentals that would be involved with this. One of the reasons why Russia has been going so much slower here in, say, the last 3 or 4 months in particular, is because they have clearly made some sort of strategic calculation that they're going to minimize friendly casualties and try to maximize enemy casualties with firepower. And so as a result, you see very, very small numbers of troops, whether it's two and three vehicles sometimes, or sometimes two and three individuals crossing in certain areas or on motorbikes, et cetera. So they don't have any mass forces. If you mass your forces, especially for Ukraine, to launch some sort of offensive, then your casualties are just going to go through the roof, because Russia has all of the ways, whether with drones, artillery, glide bombs, and the like, they could really impose huge casualties. If you don't have mass, then just like the Russians are going slow, so too would a Ukrainian. Any way you want to dice this and slice this, it's going to increase the casualties for the Ukraine side, and they don't have casualties, troops to give over. So if, and let me just ask you, do you think that if the theater really is to try and provoke some sort of a big response from Russia, that somehow that's going to make somebody in NATO go, that's terrible, I can't believe Russia's doing that, you know what, I'm going to join the war? Is there any possibility of that happening?
Well, the European NATO allies have been very timid so far, as you know, even after the kind of joining Kershans into Poland, that sort of MiG-31s at 12 minutes in Estonian sort of air, you know, airspace. But I mean, you know, the rhetoric is going up in volume all the time, particularly from the Polish side, as you've undoubtedly kind of spotted. I don't think there's, you know, they certainly don't have the troops, let alone the appetite to kind of to join in. But the risk of that grows all the time, depending, because, you know, we don't know how the Russians would respond. We can judge what they did 1 year ago, you know, with the Oreshnik. At that time, people were talking about them possibly targeting the logistics facility inside of Poland, you know, for a tactical kind of strike using conventional munitions, by the way. But I mean, actually, the point is, from the Russian perspective, you know, they're happy with this slow grinding progress, because actually they're not fighting for land, they're fighting for time. I mean, they know that the Europeans are running out of money to keep bankrolling Zelensky, and all they need to do is to have a fairly static campaign, making small probes here and there, just gradually bleeding, you know, Europe dry of cash. This is no longer really about Ukraine. It's really about sort of, you know, Europe slowly imploding upon itself as it tries, you know, to keep the war going. I think that is the real sort of fight in Putin's mind. He's fighting with time, and he's in no hurry to, you know, launch any big conventional offensive. He's happy to sit by and watch. So that's what makes, you know, Zelensky's gamble such a gamble, because he now wants to kind of, you know, go two steps up the escalation ladder, which is what the Tomahawk issue would represent. And that's why I don't think Trump will agree. But, you know, I'm possibly more optimistic than you, Danny.
You might be, but Zelensky himself is certainly not deterred by anything. In fact, a lot of boisterous comments coming in just the last 36, 48 hours out of Europe from Ursula von der Leyen again, and definitely from Mark Rutte, from your own British Secretary of Defense, all kinds of comments. And in that environment, that positive environment, and those bellicose comments from senior European leaders, you have Volodymyr Zelensky getting ready to come in town and saying this.
We have also already prepared our part of the homework ahead of the meeting with President Trump, both the military component and the economic one. Every detail, everything is ready. The agenda of our meeting with the President of the United States is very substantive, and I thank everyone who is helping. This can truly bring the war closer to an end. There is a new sanctions package from Britain, there are dozens of people who help Russia fight, and there is also a ship of the Russian fleet carrying oil. We will definitely synchronize this package in our jurisdiction and work so that other partners equally put pressure on Russia for the sake of a real end, an end to the war. Putin should earn less, and then there will be more security in the world. And things like Patriot and Tomahawks can lay a long-term foundation for peace.
So he's claiming that economic issues with sanctions and stealing Russian shadow fleet, so-called, on the seas, Tomahawks, and more help on the front line. Is there any reason to think his consequence that he claimed there, that this would bring peace and this will cause Russia to finally stop the war? How do you see it?
I see there's absolutely zero chance of that, you know, quite frankly, Danny, that, you know, even if the US, which I don't think they will, you know, agree to a handful of Tomahawks, you know, the Russians have got the weight to escalate with, you know, missiles of their own, which are better, frankly, I'm sorry to say, than the Tomahawk. So, as we saw last year. So, I mean, he's so full of his own, propaganda that you have to admire the man's confidence, quite frankly. Ukraine is a bankrupt country. It is a bankrupt country. It depends on $50 billion a year from us now, the Europe, no longer from the US, to keep the war going. And he just expects us to provide it, even though they're losing, even though Ukrainians are dying every day, the cities are being destroyed, we're getting into the winter, the energy infrastructure has been degraded again, people won't be able to heat their homes. He doesn't care. I mean, once the war's over, he's out of a job. So he's just rolling on with the same old, propaganda and meaningless and actually quite dangerous, rhetorical statements.
Okay, so I can understand why he might be saying this. As much as I disagree with it, as much as I can factually refute nearly all of his contentions and just irrational pages, he is in the mix. And he does have a lot of personal consequence if he gives in to reality. So even though he's wrong, I can understand why he would. Where I have a more difficult time, and this is what I really am asking you to help illuminate us here, is why all these senior European leaders, UK folks, France, Germany, I mean, all these folks across, obviously Poland and some of the others, why are they saying things that imply that, no, they think that really this could actually cause enough pain and pressure on Russia to get them to back down? But what is that based on, and what do they really hope to accomplish?
Well, it's not based on intelligence, and it never has been. But what I think it's based on is the fact they've invested so heavily in Zelensky, that they worry about the domestic political consequences for each of them, when he fails, as he surely will. All they're doing is kicking the can of failure down the road and hoping they'll be able to manage it, when it comes. All across Europe, we're seeing nationalist political parties on the rise because they, see the kind of globalist leaders are completely ignoring their interests, pushing a proxy war, in Ukraine, and so on. And Keir Starmer, Friedrich Merz, Emmanuel Macron, they're all in different ways in political trouble domestically. Right now, if they kind of, cut the legs from under Zelensky's chair, then they're going to have to explain to their voters why they've been saying all along that Ukraine can win when it's clear that they never could.
Well, so, that leads to my puzzlement, I guess, because you can, rationally speaking, you should be able to calculate that you can't kick that can down the road much further. And so if you continue to invest in this rhetoric and you see the political damage it's already causing to some and the danger that it's putting all those you just mentioned in there, then one would also rationally think that they would say, okay, this can only get worse for us. It can't get better. We're going to have to do something different. And yet they don't. What might be the calculation to try and kick a can down the road that will almost certainly build up more negative consequences for themselves?
I mean, part of it is just the herd mentality. I mean, political leaders don't always operate and act in rational ways, as we're seeing, especially as we're seeing in Ukraine. Friedrich Merz has another 3 years in power. Keir Starmer has another, 3 years, in office. Macron can go through to 2027. If he wants to, even though he's in political trouble, right now, that they can kick it down for another year, sell Zelensky out, next year, and still have another year or so to sort of, rebuild their fences for another election. But they, for whatever reason, they don't seem to be ready to rip off that plaster, right now. They're still stuck in their own propaganda. But as you say, that they can't kick it down the road forever. But I mean, I think, the reckoning is coming. I still personally think the war is going to go on until 2026, because I think none of them are ready to kind of face up to that, right now.
Yeah, of course, it remains to be seen whether the Ukraine army can continue to fight through into 2026, although we're getting closer toward the end of this year here, too. But I guess that there is some rationale for some of these leaders. If they think they can go that long, then maybe they feel like, all right, well, when the time comes, we'll build up some of the reason why I did everything I could and these people failed us or so. Do you see any like seeds of that being planted now where they might could say if let's say, for example, that the Ukraine army does eventually collapse and it doesn't matter how much ammunition, weapons or money you give, they just aren't able to maintain their consistency and the coherence as a fighting force and they end up collapsing. Where do you perceive that the European leaders would then switch the claims and the blame so that it's not my fault.
Yeah, I don't actually see the Ukrainian army collapse. I know lots of people talk about it. I don't see it happening. They still have, you know, a million sort of people at arms, even though some of them are forcibly, you know, put at arms. I think it's a far more resilient force. And as I said before, I think Putin is playing the long game anyway. He's not really concerned about any big Hail Mary moves. He's happy to watch, you know, the Europeans kind of, you know, bleed dry. But when that moment happens, I think actually inevitably, you know, there's going to be a big political shift within Europe, with actually definitely France, but also possibly the UK moving towards an explicitly nationalist government, you know, with a national rally in France. And very possibly, it's not inconceivable, the Reform Party in the UK. And I think the big risk there when that happens, because I don't think they will be able to package failure. They've been lying to people for so long about this stupid war, you know, saying that, you know, that Putin's going to die tomorrow and the economy is going to implode the next day and that sort of thing for so long. You know, people will see right through that. So I don't think there is a good way to package it. So, I mean, you know, the big systemic risk here is to the European Union itself, you know, because if France, you know, gets national rally, they decide to leave, then that sort of means potentially the whole project is going to implode when they realize that they can't afford to actually, you know, bring Ukraine into full membership anyway, because they don't have the money. So, I mean, it's just Europe literally is in a sort of slow death spiral right now. That's how I see it. And that's, you know, why the fear factor is so high, why people don't want to kind of confront this awful kind of burning elephant in the corner of the room. You know,
what's really sad, you may be right. I've often said that it's impossible to tell ahead of time what an army is going to do when it comes under pressure. For example, you had the German army in World War II that never broke, no matter how much they couldn't win, no matter how thin their troops got. They fought all the way to the literal end in Berlin, and they never gave up, even though there was literally no hope for success. And then you had, at the first of World War II, the British and French armies in France, who were supposed to be the most powerful continental forces on the planet, and instead they buckled in less than a month when things turned upside down. You just never know. So I can't make any predictions, but the one thing I'll point out is the perversity and the catastrophe. If they did the German model and never broke, all that would do is ensure that even more of them die an unnecessary death. And what a cruel twist of fate that would be. But we'll have to wait and see how that's going to work out.
And the thing is, you know, Russia isn't needing to do any sort of mass mobilization of troops. I mean, by all accounts, and I follow, you know, I do still have friends in Russia, you know, sue me. But, you know, life is for many people carrying on largely as normal there, actually. But that's not the same in Ukraine. You know, young men above the age of 25 still are being dragged off the streets. That simply isn't happening in Russia. That's another reason why, you know, Putin doesn't really want to kind of, you know, go big on it, because actually, you know, his country is kind of carrying on a fairly normal existence, you know, while watching Europe die. There's no need for him to do any more than that right now, it seems to me.
You can certainly make that argument. One of the arguments on the other side, though, is what we're claiming, and maybe part of the reason why some of these leaders have these views that they can keep going on the Western I'm talking about, is you have people like General Ben Hodges. I hesitate to even bring him up, haven't brought him in for a while, but some of the stuff he's saying right now is still getting currency. People are still listening to it. And here's what he thinks, that he's kind of echoing, in a sense, what Trump said in the Truth Social a little over a week ago, that Russia's a paper tiger. Here's his version.
I have always believed that Ukraine was going to win this war and that Russia was moving towards trouble. But now it feels like, at least in the White House, now they have like, holy shit, the Ukrainians are doing good. The Russians are failing. And other people are now starting to realize this false narrative out there that the Russians, of course, were pushing, that it was inevitable that they would win. There was no way that little Ukraine could beat mighty Russia. And that's been proven false. Now, you know, how's the war going depends a little bit on where you're fighting. If you're in a trench outside Pokrovsk, or if you're in a city that is constantly hit by Russian missiles, it's terrible. But if you can step back from the terrible tactical situation and look at the bigger picture, there's no way that Russia, in my view, can actually defeat Ukraine
You know, that's painful to me to watch, even again, as I just watched it, because you see him lay the foundation in the first half that now it's been proven that Russia can't win and Ukraine is improving. They're doing better. And then he actually says with his own mouth, of course, if you look at the tactical situation, well, that sucks for Ukraine. And if you look at the operational situation in the air, well, yeah, that sucks too, because there's no counter for any of it. But everywhere else, it's good. And now then, when you look at the bigger picture, what's the bigger picture if this close picture is bad? I think if you look at the bigger picture, you tell me if I'm wrong, is even worse than the tactical view.
Well, it is, because Ukraine is becoming a failed state, and it's a failed state that Europe will have to pay for. I mean, that is the big picture. I mean, all the stuff about trenches in Pokrovsk, he's right. It's probably the only thing he was right on. You know, it is correct. I mean, it must be absolutely horrendous. There, the big picture is Ukraine is a failed state, and we are helping it to fail, and we're paying for the privilege as well at the cost of $50 to $80 billion a year. Because it's not just the $50 billion a year to fight the war; it's the $30 billion a year to make up for their massive current account deficits every year as well, because they can't export anything. Even Poland won't import their grain because it's too cheap. Good old Poland. So, you know, that is the big picture, state failure, and it's on our cards, and we're paying for that massive golden card, which, you know, Zelensky will bank somewhere in, you know, Switzerland or the British Virgin Islands, no doubt.
Yeah, and I want to just kind of show people what we're talking about, since he brought it up, is the tactical situation. And I'll just look at two big ones here. This is the Pokrovsk agglomeration, what they call here. And you can see that Russia has, it's still slow, but you see now then half of the city is either under full or most Russian control. They've taken the citadel here in the south. Now then they're moving further close into the southern part of Mirnograd. Here in this the southern part of it here, we're moving into the north. This is where you mentioned a minute ago that Ukraine has tried some counterattacks. And these are some of the areas where they've tried to cut off this penetration here north of Pokrovsk. They have not succeeded, whereas now Russia is trying to move back into Shakhova. They've taken this Volodymyrovka in the south, retaken that a couple of times. This has changed hands actually several times here, but yeah. Ukraine doesn't have the power to block it off. And then the other big one up here in the north, of course, is to Kupiansk. And then you see that now is more than half taken or controlled fully by the Russian side. Only these parts of it are still on the Ukraine control, and there's just nothing that's going to reverse it. Nothing, even these tactical operations that come, all they do is just put a temporary dent, and then Russia will end up losing. I'm saying the Ukraine will end up losing what they had gained here. So when you look at the tactical side, that's what you see. When you look at the operational side, Russia is continuing to expand their capability in these long-range drones. Their missile capacity continues to expand everywhere you look. So big picture, medium picture, large picture, you know, what the heck? I don't understand why people keep on saying this stuff over and over.
Yeah, well, Hodges, I mean, goodness me, you know, he's just yet another talking head, really. I mean, he sounds like somebody who's read absolutely nothing in detail about sort of Russian doctrine at all. And he's just kind of making things up as he goes along. You know, we have British generals who do exactly the same thing. So it's nothing personal, but, you know, this seems to kind of run hot in the gung-ho community.
Well, you say you bring up the issue of some of the British officials. There was something I saw just this morning in the UK where MI5, the director, I think is his title, made some pretty alarming statements about some increasing threats to the UK country.
I'd like to take stock with you today, because we are in a new era. MI5's fight against terrorism remains intense. My teams are running near record volumes of investigations, but we are also having to contend with a second menace of equal or even greater scale in fast-rising state threats. In 2025, a more hostile world is forcing the biggest shifts in MI5's mission since 9/11.
That's saying something. The biggest shift since 9/11, and he was talking about both terrorism and state threats, which he went on to talk about both Russia and China were onto that. What is behind all this?
Well, he probably wants more money. he probably wants buying it. But, you know, we've got this big scandal at the moment about this this spy case against somebody, a parliamentary aide and an academic in China who are actually being handled as covert human intelligence sources by a Chinese handler onto, you know, Xi Jinping's right-hand man. And the case has just collapsed. And there are a lot of red faces over here right now about that. So, you know, we're at the head of MI5 to talk about this, to sort of take people's attention away from it and actually to pick up the China threat, because that's what it's really about, that this botched case against two people who, in my view, you know, show all the kind of signs of having been spying for Chinese, one of whom was working in the China Research Group, this kind of hawkish parliamentary group that was set up by Conservative Party hawks to kind of come up with ideas to kind of constrain China. Well, the director of that was working for the Chinese intelligence, and it's been a cock up of monumental proportions because, you know, the criminal case has collapsed against them. So that's the background to that, Danny.
So is it just that one issue there, or did he have any, is it valid that there are, he said his office had, you know, a huge spike in number of cases, both on anti counterterrorism stuff and also from China and Russia. Is that all made up, or is there some substance behind it? Do they really have those kinds of threats?
So there are two things. There's a counterintelligence, counterespionage kind of threat, obviously, that, you know, that's front and center right now because of this kind of China spy case. But there's also the hybrid threats. We just had one of our biggest kind of automotive manufacturers shut down and having to be bailed out to the tune of, I think, more than £1 billion, you know, pounds, Jaguar Land Rover, following a hybrid attack, we believe possibly by a state actor. So it's that kind of threat that we're dealing with now. The hybrid attacks on our industries, which erode our economic capabilities, is a big thing. And, you know, the counter-espionage is there. But that really, the counter-espionage is nothing new. I mean, that's not a new threat. I mean, it's kind of the really hybrid threats that are worrying people right now.
I see. So I guess we'll keep an eye on that, too. I want to go back something to this, something that President Trump said yesterday in that same press conference where I mentioned, or I showed you the clip of him saying that Ukraine wants to go on the offensive, et cetera. He was asked a whole bunch of questions, some related to the Russia-Ukraine, some related to some other things. But there was one thing he said in particular that was related to the Russia-Ukraine war, in that he claimed that
I was not happy that India was buying oil. And he assured me today that they will not be buying oil from Russia. That's a big stop. Now I got to get China to do the same thing.
So he says, yeah, good news. India's told me yesterday, I talked to Modi. No problem. He says, they're not going to buy any oil. That's a big thing. But just before we came on air here, there was one of the spokesmen for the Indian government came on and said this.
I'm not aware of any conversation yesterday between the two leaders. We have noticed the latest sanctions announced by the UK. As I have said this earlier as well, and possibly most of you are aware of it as well, that we do not subscribe to any unilateral sanctions. Government of India considers the provision of energy security a responsibility of paramount importance. To meet the
basic that's good enough there, Gary. So what do you make of that? Where Trump just categorically saying, yeah, Modi promised me he wouldn't do this. And he went into more detail later. I don't need to go into that part. But now then you see that India's going, I'm not aware of any conversation. What do you make of that?
Well, Trump's got this habit of seemingly making things up as he goes along. I don't know whether that's just because he's badly advised by his people in the White House, but I see no circumstance in which India would agree to that. I mean, that they've had a record surge in oil purchases from Russia since. I mean, that they were actually, even before the Chinese, you know, the Indians were the ones who stepped in first to really up their imports of Russian oil after the war started. I mean, China has been played a huge part. There's no way in this God's earth that China will agree to stop buying Russian oil. It just isn't going to happen.
It's interesting also that same spokesman earlier in the day, or maybe it was even yesterday when he first made the comment, said India is going to make its purchases based on national interest and our economic interest and what is important to us. and it's going to continue to be that way. And the implication being that this is not in their interest. So one would wonder if you ask them to stop doing something that would significantly increase the cost of their doing business across the board, where is the motivation to try and get them to do it? How could India even accomplish that if they wanted to?
Well, they couldn't. And of course, you know, the Indians will be looking at the European example where European industry is deindustrializing because energy prices have doubled. Look at Germany, Volkswagen closing factories in Germany, almost unthinkable, you know, before the war started. And, you know, Europe is becoming a bit of a basket case economically because of energy security issues, first and foremost, you know, in terms of industrial, you know, strategy. And the, you know, the Indians are not stupid. They're very smart people. They're going to look at Europe's experience. They say, well, no, thanks very much. We'll just, you know, keep on, you know, getting energy from wherever we can. And that economically, that is absolutely the right decision for them. Has to be.
And he also said, he goes, you know, there's kind of a double standard here. He was trying to be polite, like most Indians are in public.
Yeah.
And he said, you know, European countries are still buying oil from Russia. And in fact, there was an article out just 1 week ago that showed how 7 European countries had accelerated the amount of Russian oil and gas they have bought in this calendar year here. And so they're saying, why do you want to penalize us and not them too? Does he have a point? Yeah.
He has a point, because the thing about the particular gas, you know, to Europe is that what Europe have done, they've cut off piped gas, all the gas pipelines, they've all been shut off, right? One of them has blown up. You know, was it the Americans? Was it the you know, Ukrainians? Who knows? Who cares? But I mean, but actually LNG from Russia still comes in. And, you know, like LNG from the US, that gets arbitraged and the price goes massively up. So actually the Russian gas they get is costing far more than actually the pipe gas they were getting, which they've now cut off. So it is absolutely true that, you know, policymakers in Brussels are sanctioning the purchase of extremely expensive, you know, Russian gas. It isn't just that it's Russian. It also costs a fortune.
Yeah, that's not very helpful. And one just wonders how Trump is going to manage this one by what you've said and then going back. But that's not an uncommon thing for this current administration. We have to admit that a lot of things are said and then either ignored or walked back later. We'll see how this one unfolds too. But that contradiction does raise an issue about how the United States is viewed globally, but both among friends and adversaries and potential opponents or enemies even. And it matters how you're viewed, I think. And there was a conversation in Moscow earlier today, I believe it was, where Putin was asked some issues about this ongoing issue with the United States. And I think it was in the context of, are Tomahawks going to be used and what would we do? And then he said, let's take a look at the bigger picture here. There's a problem that he sees.
Свои интересы и якобы свою безопасность за тысячи километров от своей национальной территории. Они это делали, вот наиболее такие жесткие и то, что делали яркие наши вещи. Партнеры, так, без всякой санкции Совета Безопасности ООН. Вот Югославию бомбили. Под каким предлогом? Что санкции Совета Безопасности, что ли? Наши партнеры. Где Югославия, где США? Уничтожили страну. Да, там внутренний конфликт, там свои проблемы. Но кто дал право наносить удары по европейской столице? Никто. Просто так и решили. А сателлиты за ними бежали сзади, подтявкивали. Вот и все международное право. А под каким предлогом вошли в Ирак? Разработка оружия массового уничтожения в Ираке. Зашли, страну разрушили, создали очаг международного терроризма. А потом выяснилось, что ошиблись. Потом сказали, нас разведка подвела. Ничего себе. Страну разрушили, страну разведка подвела. И все. И все объяснение. Оказывается, не было там никакого оружия массового поражения. Никто не готовил. Наоборот, когда-то было все как положено, уничтожили. А в Сирию как зашли? Что, санкции Совета Безопасности? Нет. Что хотят, то и делают.
Но то, что они сейчас делают на территории Украины, или пытаются делать, или планируют делать, это же не за тысячи километров от нашей национальной границы. Это у порога нашего дома.
And, you know, listen, I mean, a lot of that is just a recounting of the factual track record. You know, he's tossed off of Yugoslavia. We went in there with military power in the Balkans during the Clinton administration. We just decided that what was happening in there, an internal issue, was not an internal issue. We had the right to go in and do something. So we had this big, long bombing campaign that happens. He talked about Iraq, weapons of mass destructions. There weren't any. And just, oh, this intelligence failure. And yet we overthrew an entire country and threw the region into turmoil, where we still have troops to this day. He talked about Syria, where both the, I think it was Obama, Biden, and Trump administrations, at one time or another, all used military force in there. Never was the UNSC. U.S. put troops on the ground during the Obama administration. They never left. They're there to this day with no international authorization. He talks about the situation in Ukraine, how thousands of miles there, we're deciding who is the winners and losers, et cetera. And he might also have added Venezuela. The situation going on right now in the Caribbean, where with no international justice, we're blowing boats up and we've killed 27 people so far with no apparent justification that I'm aware of. But that's what Trump wants to do. Or maybe back in, I think it was 2011, 2013 in Libya, where we destroyed that regime and just left the wreckage to fall on the ground. And there's still all this dueling countries, governments to this day. That is a problem to me, because we want to be seen as the protector of democracy, and we lay this foundation for the rule of law, the international rules-based order, all that kind of stuff. But Ian, I've got to ask, what is that international rules-based order that facilitates all of that list?
Well, it doesn't exist, actually, or in terms of how the West see it. The international rules-based order is the United Nations Charter of 1947, signed in good old San Francisco, home of my favorite NFL team. But actually, that is the basis of the international rules in a messy kind of global, you know, landscape. Everything else since then is really what at least Putin sees as, you know, US-led attempt to kind of, you know, dominate the world in a unipolar way. But what was most, or what should be most troubling from that video was, even though he repeated things that he's repeated many times before on Yugoslavia, on Iraq, he said it many, many times. He sounded really quite angry in that to me, having studied him quite a long time now. And the message I got from that was, we're just not going to take it in Ukraine. And, you know, during that conversation today, if the subject of Tomahawks come up, you know, the message is going to be very loud and clear to Trump. And there will be a really strong response from the Russian side if that happens.
That's kind of what I got to, especially there toward the end of that that clip. You saw some consternation on his face, and he's usually really good about not doing that. He's just kind of matter of fact. But I got the same sense, and one wonders if that's going to translate into anything on the ground. There have been lots of reports that I have seen from some of my contacts that have access to Russian thinking, et cetera, some that we've got through this channel and some others that are actually saying that there is a growing dissatisfaction with Putin, not for the conduct of the war, but for the fact he hasn't conducted it hard enough. And I wonder if through any of your sources, if you've seen anything along that lines, or if you've seen anything different.
I mean, that's been a theme for quite a long time now, in fact, and Putin's gamble. I mean, Putin is always trying to spin the plates in Russia. People don't seem to understand that. They think he's all powerful. He's not. He's got different factions, a kind of more West-leaning faction, the much, much more hardline factions, you know, as well. And he's always trying to kind of balance all of those, you know, competing factors. But that those voices, you know, are growing louder now as Trump's efforts to bring peace have delivered nothing, you know, frankly. Since he came to office, and people are getting frustrated now, particularly now that Zelensky, who people see as corrupt, you know, a dictator, is just able to kind of call the shots, you know, from afar. And so, I mean, this is actually quite a dangerous moment, I think, in the war. But I'm hoping that sort of with Trump, common sense will prevail. But I mean, I think, you know, really, if he's serious about bringing to, you know, the war in Ukraine to an end, he could have done it. He could have done it. He got the Europeans to kind of commit 5% NATO defense spending, which, by the way, is mostly going to benefit US defense contractors. You know, he should be able to kind of roll over them to actually drag Zelensky to the table to make peace. And he hasn't done that. And that has been Trump's failure. That there's a risk that he's just all talk, frankly, and no action. And I suspect today Putin may give him a cold shower if he talks about Tomahawk missiles.
Yeah, well, I guess we'll have to wait and see on that. Let me ask you before we let you go, kind of looking at the other half of that calculation, the other side of that, not from the Russian perspective, but from the Western perspective. Because when you take a look at that, when you talk about Yugoslavia, there's still U.S. and European troops still there to this day. And there are still some challenges, then the thing can still bubble over. Obviously, Iraq, I mean, now it's pro Iran as it can get. We still have troops there. We still have troops on the ground in Syria. Obviously, nothing's been solved with Ukraine. We could certainly add in the Afghanistan disaster on top of all that. Now we're trying to maybe add another quagmire in Venezuela. And even though we failed to unseat their government during the first Trump administration in the 2018 timeframe. So it's been nothing but disaster everywhere. Libya, as I just said, is a complete disaster. Is there ever going to be a point, do you think, to where public opinion or even leaders at various places finally stand up in the West and say, this is an absolute catastrophe and a massive drain on all of our economies, and it produces nothing of any value except for more chaos and insecurity? Do you think that can ever happen?
Well, that is a process I outlined earlier that's happening right now in Europe with the shift towards this kind of moderate nationalism across the continent, with the exception of Poland and the Balts, which kind of living in the world completely of their own, quite frankly. But in Central Europe, in France, in particular in France right now, but also in the UK and in Germany, you know, I think that change is happening, and it's going to be a painful change. And it's, you know, that's why Rutte, Merz, Macron, Starmer, von der Leyen, Kallas, all of these kind of potentates are kicking the can down the road because they're worried about what it means for them, you know, losing their power. And I think that is the change that's happening right now. Whether it happens in the US, I don't really know. But I mean, it's certainly happening here right now. So the next decade is going to be rocky politically for Europe, but hopefully some good will come out of that. But they're saying, well, why can't we just get on with other countries and, you know, stop trying to kind of cure them of their ills? You know, like sort of, you know, Christian missionaries from the 15th century.
Yeah, let's take a look at curing some of our own ills. Might go a long way on that. And you don't have to abandon in international engagement. You just have to try and not be so prescriptive like what we seem to be doing right now, because it's been disaster. Let's hope that continues on. I do want to believe that there is some movement on that, that there are still plenty of people who are willing to be rational and logical and look at, just calculate the realities on the ground for the benefit of their own countries, without, you know, literally turning isolationist, because that's one of the charges that's what it leads to. But right now we're looking at not compounding problems further. We'll see how it works out. But listen, we really appreciate you coming on and providing, especially this lens on the European side and how they view things over on your side of the pond, as they say. And we're really grateful for that. Thank you for coming
on. Always great to see you, Danny. All the best. Bye for now.
Thank you very much. And we will look forward to seeing you this afternoon on the Daniel Davis Deep Dive, where we're going to take a look at some more of these issues that President Trump mentioned a little bit. Also, we got this Venezuela thing I mentioned a little bit. More information on that. You're going to want to tune in today at 2 p.m. on the Daniel Davis Deep Dive, and we'll see you then.